Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's day one of the 2020 Republican National Convention. Last week, I said that the pandemic has held up a mirror to the stark realities of American life and that the conventions are the party's chance at offering up what they wish would be reflected back, their vision for the future of the country. That was certainly true for the Democrats in their convention last week. So what vision will Republicans be offering this week? What's the case they'll be making for President Trump's re-election? That's what we'll be taking a look at this hour. And we'll start today in Charlotte, North Carolina, where more than 300 GOP delegates are gathering for an in-person roll call to kick off the convention. And Steve Harrison is there. He's a political reporter at Charlotte's NPR affiliate station, WFAE. Steve, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, give us a snapshot into what we might expect to see today in day one in Charlotte.
So this has been, for Charlotte, such a strange 2 years, just to back up a little bit, because Charlotte was picked to host the convention. It was a reluctant city to do so. And then, of course, we had the coronavirus pandemic, and the GOP moved most of the convention to Jacksonville, Florida, then canceled that. And now we're here in Charlotte for a half-day business-only convention at our convention center where, like you said earlier, there are 336 delegates kind of doing a formal roll call to nominate Trump and Pence for a second term.
And so that's going to be a much diminished roll call from what it usually is in conventions, right, where it takes quite a bit. There's a lot of fanfare as we go from state to state. The entire delegation is there on the convention floor under, you know, back in the normal times. So is this going to have, do we know if this is at all going to have any of the pomp, even if on a smaller scale, that we usually have in a convention?
So they are trying, but one of the things was to even have this event at all, the GOP had to kind of put forth this elaborate health plan to satisfy North Carolina's Democratic governor. So you've got this giant ballroom, and the delegates, you know, are kind of spread out at different tables. So you don't have people packed together. There's not a lot of energy. Some people inside are wearing masks. Some people are not. So it's this strange. Now, they are trying. I mean, the delegates there are excited. They hope President Trump comes later in the day to give some sort of speech. But there's no official word if even that's going to happen.
So, I mean, obviously, it's the pandemic that's driving all the changes that the parties have to make for their conventions here. Can you just give us some insight into how the pandemic is playing out right now in North Carolina or in Charlotte in particular?
Well, North Carolina has been a state that's been pretty cautious about reopening. So North Carolina never saw a big spike in COVID cases. But it's very real here. There are many restrictions still in place. Bars are closed. And like I said earlier, for the GOP to even pull off this small business meeting, they had to go to great lengths to convince the state to allow it to happen. I mean, I talked about masks and social distancing. One interesting thing is that every delegate at this small meeting, on their badge, they have a little fob with Bluetooth technology that basically tracks who else they come in contact with. So if someone gets sick later on, then they can run that badge and see, oh, well, this person was in contact with these five people, and they can reach them for contact tracing. So it's just such a strange event. But having said that, I mean, the Republicans were kind of very determined to do something in person, to not give up and not to try and make this a little different from the DNC that we saw last week.
Got it. Well, so let's zoom out a little bit here away from Charlotte and across North Carolina more broadly. Sort of what's this, the status of the presidential race in North Carolina? What are the polls saying? What are voters saying about where their minds are right now?
So the polls put put North Carolina pretty much a dead heat, maybe even former Vice President Biden a little bit ahead. I think that the trick for Democrats is that North Carolina is talked about for the last several elections is this purple state, this swing state. But remember, Democrats have only won it once at the presidential level since 1976. That was when Obama won it just barely in 2008. So, but for Democrats, North Carolina is not a, they don't have to win it. This would be running up the score. For Republicans, it is a must-win race. There's really no path for Trump to win the White House again without taking North Carolina. Kind of a, you know, a second part of that is that there is a very competitive Senate race here. Tom Tillis, the Republican who's in his first term, is in a very close race with Cal Cunningham, the Democrat. That's one of those key races that the Democrats hope to win if they want to flip the Senate.
Well, so can you just tell us a little bit more about that, Steve? Because, I mean, is it possible? I mean, we've seen it happen time and again where voters might vote one way for who they want to see in the White House, but vote another way in for their Senate or House picks. So could we see that split there in North Carolina this year?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely. I think there's a history in North Carolina of the Senate candidates and especially the governor on the Democratic side outperforming the Democratic presidential candidate. The Democratic governor here, Roy Cooper, is very popular. There were a significant share 4 years ago of Trump voters who also voted for Roy Cooper, the Democrat. So I think it's certainly very possible that Trump could squeak out a victory in North Carolina and that Cal Cunningham, the Senate candidate, could win because Tom Tillis, the Republican incumbent, has some problems with the Republican base because he has been seen as someone who is not loyal enough to the president, not conservative enough. When the president held a couple rallies here in North Carolina over the past couple of years and mentioned Tom Tillis's name, there were a few boos in the crowd. So you could definitely have a situation where Trump edges out a victory in North Carolina, but the Democrats pick up a Senate seat.
Interesting. Well, Steve Harrison, political reporter for WFAE in Charlotte. Thank you so much for joining us, Steve.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's turn now to Phil Rucker. He's White House bureau chief for The Washington Post, also co-author of A Very Stable Genius, and he's joining us from Washington. Phil, welcome to the program.
Here.
Hi, Phil. So, you know, you just heard Steve there interestingly describe to us that in that North Carolina Senate race, Republican Tom Tillis might be in a little bit of trouble because he's not seen as loyal enough to the Republican base, to the Trump base. So I wanted to use that as a jumping off point in terms of what we might see this week in the Republican National Convention. Is it going to be a convention really focused on those voters on President Trump's base?
Well, the Republican National Convention is going to be a Trump show all week. You know, it's a gathering every 4 years for the Republican Party. But in this year, in this moment, it's really a reaffirmation of Donald Trump and everything about Trump. We're going to hear, we're expected to hear from the president himself each of the four nights in their primetime programming. But we're also going to hear from most of his children, from other staff members of his. It's a very sort of Trumpified personal convention that showcases the president and appeals to his base. Now, talking to Republican officials the last few days, they've said the president's going to try to reach out more broadly to expand his coalition by sounding optimistic and hopeful, by talking about what he's doing with the coronavirus. But the reality is this is a president who likes dark imagery, who is set to try to demonize Joe Biden and to inflame some of the cultural wars that we've seen playing out around the country, just given who some of the speakers are going to be. So I would fully anticipate this being a convention that really galvanizes the Trump base.
So, Phil, what do you think the party, or actually, let's focus specifically, that that President Trump needs to accomplish through the convention this week? What does his goal need to be?
There are a few things that he needs to do, and this is, you know, not my personal view, but it's according to, mm-hmm. you know, some really smart Republican strategists that I've been talking to the last few days who say that the most important thing for him to do is to confront the coronavirus head on and to deal with the fact that a majority of Americans disapprove of his performance and his management of this pandemic, to try to help change the opinions of Americans, to give them reason to think he's doing the right thing on the virus, to give them some optimism about a vaccine, to make them feel a little bit more comfortable with how he's handled this pandemic. You know, the other thing that Republicans believe he would be smart to do is to talk about economic policy. It's one of the selling points from his first 3 years as president. And of course, he had anticipated running for reelection based on his economic record. Now we're in a recession and the economy has collapsed because of this virus. And so Trump could serve himself well by making an argument about why it is that there was so much job growth in those first 3 years and what he specifically would do going forward to try to help the economy recover from this pandemic.
So that's what Republican strategists are saying that the president needs to talk about this week. But Phil, I think you were saying a little earlier, having observed what the president's predilections are in terms of what he likes to talk about, do you feel confident that he will indeed follow what the strategists are recommending?
I am confident that somewhere on his scripted remarks on the teleprompter, there will be discussion of the virus and of the economy. But I am also very confident that the kind of high points of the speech, the headlines we end up remembering may well be his dark characterizations of what America could look like under a Biden presidency. He has used pretty extreme rhetoric the last few weeks in the run-up to the campaign to warn of the destruction of America as we know it, to warn that the election might be rigged in his assessment. Of course, there's no evidence of that sort of voter fraud, but the president's talking about it nonetheless. And to call Joe Biden a radical and say that he and Senator Harris are part of this left-wing radical mob. So I assume we'll be hearing a lot of that this week at the convention.
Well, we are talking this hour about day one of the 2020 Republican National Convention. We'll have a lot more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is day one of the Republican 2020 National Convention. We're talking about what we expect to see today and throughout the week as the Republican Party makes its case for the re-election of President Donald Trump. I'm joined today by Phil Rucker. He's White House Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. And joining us now from Austin, Texas, is Republican strategist Matt Mikowiak. He's president of Potomac Strategy Group, a conservative consulting firm, and chair of the Travis County Republican Party. Matt, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So lay out the case that you think the GOP needs to make this week for the re-election of President Trump. What's the best message that the GOP could put forward?
Yeah, I think realistically, having now seen what the Democrats did last week, the opportunity that's there for President Trump is to try to shift this from being a referendum election primarily on his response on coronavirus to a choice election primarily on the economy. That doesn't mean he should ignore the coronavirus. I agree with Phil's assessment that he expects that there will be some mention of that, particularly in his remarks on Thursday. And he should take that on and explain what they've done and explain why it's better than some of the worst predictions that were out there. But really, he needs to make this a choice election about the economy, who can rebuild the economy, how the two visions between the two parties are so different, and why that would be of benefit to working class Americans, particularly in these battleground states, particularly in the Rust Belt, in the Midwest, in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, and yes, even Minnesota, which may become a really crucial swing state.
So, in talking about the economy, how can the president do that or talk about how to rebuild the economy without acknowledging that this economic collapse has happened under his watch?
Well, sure. And I don't think he's going to pretend it's not there. There is a lot of pain out there, but we are seeing some encouraging signs. If you look at, you know, retail sales, if you look at housing starts, if you look at the expected third quarter growth, if you look at private sector hiring, these things are all going in the right direction. If I remember at the low point, we were around 13% national unemployment. I think we're at 9.5 or 10% now, or it might even be a little higher than that, but it should be down to around 10% by the election. So things are headed in the right direction. And that is obviously not as strong a message as he had in January, February in the economy, particularly in January when he was making his State of the Union address. Things have changed. There's no question. And so now it's not about him, you know, taking responsibility for where we are. It's about instead saying, listen, we are where we are. Who do you think has the best chance to help you and your family recover, to see the kind of economic growth, to build back those wages growing in private sector hiring and to help our manufacturing sectors? These are the opportunities that he has ahead of him. He has to take advantage of them.
And so then the same question about talking about the pandemic itself, because again, the fact is that any discussion about the pandemic will ultimately bring us back to the fact that we have 170,000 Americans who have died under the president's watch. So how can he possibly talk about that without acknowledging the fundamental failures that have happened?
Yeah, and I think it would be a mistake to offer, you know, happy talk on the coronavirus at this point. You know, I do think he wants to offer hope. You saw the announcement yesterday on convalescent plasma, the emergency use authorization by FDA. You're going to see, I think, antivirals and treatments become more available in the next month. And presumably, we're going to continue to move forward with Operation Warp Speed on the vaccine. All of that is very positive, but surely you can't do anything about what's happened, about the lives lost, about all the harm, about, you know, the uncertainty. The fear that people have had, the small businesses. I think I saw something just in the last couple of days that predicted 1 in 4 restaurants would close. The economic devastation is almost unprecedented, certainly in a situation like this. And so he needs to be sober and admit that. I think he's done that in his press conferences in the last few weeks more soberly. He's talked about the necessity of wearing masks. It would be to his advantage to admit some mistakes were made and that we've learned some things and that this was extremely difficult. But I think, again, it's about offering hope and saying, look, we've learned a lot. We're much closer to the end of this than the beginning. And we're going to continue to unify as a country and bring the absolute best science and best technological advancement to this to try to eradicate this virus.
Yeah. So it's interesting that that convalescent plasma example that you brought up. I mean, that's one of the, in fact, it's actually a perfect little way for me to ask my next question to you is that was a big announcement, a lot of fanfare around it. But the truth was that there has not been a single randomized controlled trial done around the use of convalescent plasma. So we actually don't fully yet know. We cannot say with scientific confidence how effective it's going to be. And yet the Trump administration made this really big announcement. So I wonder if, are we still going to see sort of the same habits with the president throughout this week and in focusing on small things that don't necessarily have a basis in hard reality, but use those as examples for like for his successes and why he should be reelected.
Yeah, and look, this is one of my frustrations at times, and that is, you know, the Democrats and folks in the media from time to time say, why won't Trump do more? Why won't he show leadership? And then, you know, he takes a bold step like he did yesterday and say, look, we are going to put this into an emergency use authorization. You're correct. It has not gone through every single possible test, but there have been encouraging results. This kind of gets to that idea of right to try. You know, if a doctor wants to use this kind of treatment, we should make it available. It should be up to the doctor to decide. And the doctors are going to be far more knowledgeable on the efficacy of this approach. Look, we know that he gets defensive about the coronavirus response. There's no question about that. He likes to point to, you know, shutting down flights of foreign citizens from China into the United States in February, and then later in March from Europe. He has a couple things he points to. And he does pay attention to the estimates that put, you know, the number of deaths perhaps at the 1 to 2.5 million range. I think he's gotten about all the mileage he's going to get out of those 2 points. You're going to probably see him make them again. I do think, since this is a set piece, you know, set up speech where he is delivering a message from a teleprompter, that my hope is that it will be a better message. It'll be more finely calibrated. It'll be sober at times, but also hopeful, but very realistic. This is an opportunity to expand his coalition. If all they do at the convention is sort of scratch the itch of his base, it's a tremendously costly missed opportunity. He has a real opportunity, I think, with 20 to 30 million people tuning in on Thursday night, to expand that coalition. And I think you're going to see that with some of these speakers from countries that have had, you know, socialist dictators, to Alice Johnson, the woman who was let out of jail because of the criminal justice reform. They're going to have lots of different speakers with lots of different perspectives over the next 4 days. I think the opportunity to grow that coalition is there.
So, Phil Rucker, let me turn back to you. Just wanted to get your response or thoughts on the things that you've been hearing. Do you see that same opportunity there for the president in the RNC this week?
Oh, absolutely. Matt's correct to say that this is a big opportunity for the president. It's frankly probably his biggest opportunity between now and the election to have total control of what he's communicating to the American public, and to try to kind of reset the narrative of this campaign, which has not been in his favor the last several months. I mean, the polls show him behind Joe Biden nationally and in many of the battleground states, and Trump needs to try to shift the momentum in this race, and this is a chance for him to do that. But it would require, you know, real discipline. It'll require a clear and well-delivered and well-presented message. And, you know, we'll see if they can pull it off. But certainly the opportunity is there.
So, I mean, we can talk a lot about what the opportunities are. And at the same time, though, Matt, let me just turn back to you here. I think it's an inescapable truth that the president enjoys speaking directly to his base, that he has tailored his messaging to his base. I mean, are you concerned at all that ultimately, regardless of what is planned for the next 4 days, that when the president has his opportunities to stand in front of that camera, that is what's going to end up happening?
So if you look at the president of the last 3.5 years, and few people have followed him as closely and chronicled him as well as Phil has, there's been a distinction in the way that he communicates. When he's at a press conference or when he is at a rally, he's off the cuff. He's, you know, reacting to people's responses and feedback and emotions, and he's kind of, you know, going with his gut. When he gives these set piece addresses, which is more of a set piece address, even though technically the RNC and the campaign are in charge of it, it will be with teleprompters, with a very large audience. It's a very serious moment. And even 4 years ago, you know, his national address, you know, that he gave as the nominee was more of a set piece. So if you look at major speeches he's given, whether it was Riyadh, whether it's other speeches in Europe on major issues, he's really stuck to the text. And so I do expect him to do that. I really do expect that. And my hope is, if the RNC and the convention have set out this plan, they just put out their second term agenda with 50 items on it, they have all these speakers that are going to speak to different aspects of what the message they're trying to convey. Presumably you would have the presidential acceptance speech would be reflecting all those messages. It would be summarizing all of that and trying to reset the race from the best possible position. So that's my expectation. If he goes out there and he wings it and he goes back to sort of his, you know, greatest hits of grievances, that would be a tremendous missed opportunity. You might even see his job approval come back down to the high 30s. He has got to get his job approval in the mid 40s. If he can do that, his job approval and his reelect number have been tracking within 2 points for the last year. If he can be at 45 or 46% by late September, he's got a chance to win narrowly based on the Electoral College. If it gets into a grievance session with all of his greatest hits, not only is it a missed opportunity and that there's an opportunity cost there, but you may see it go back to that very hardcore base of support that he has, which is not going to be enough to defeat Joe Biden.
Yeah. So let me ask you honestly, Matt, though. I mean, I hear your analysis, and it seems to be well-grounded in terms of what the president needs to do. But President Trump is who he is. I give him total credit for, you know, fully being himself all the time. I'm really honestly wondering if you think he can do exactly what you're saying he needs to do.
Well, again, given that he's in a setting, I guess he'll be in a setting at the White House. I don't know whether they're going to have a crowd there. I imagine they will, some type of crowd. But given the importance of the moment and given that it's not a moment given to sort of off-the-cuff remarks, it's not a rally. He does have a teleprompter at the rallies, but he really just relies on it sort of at the beginning and at the end. And it's not a press conference. It's a different type of event. And so can he do it? We'll see. I mean, you know, predicting Donald Trump's behavior has been a risky endeavor for some time. But we can look to how he's conducting himself the first 3.5 years. I see this more as a major speech like he gave in Riyadh or like he's given in Europe at different times of his presidency. If I remember, his convention speech 3.5 years ago, 4 years ago, was also off teleprompter. It had a fairly dark message. And that is, I think, one of the real risks that they face is if he wants to give an American Carnage style speech, that it's different when you are just coming into office or when you're the outsider that's running. He's now the incumbent. It's a different type of race. It's one of the challenges that they, I think they have found in trying to run a 2016 style campaign in 2020 when you're the incumbent. He's still anti-establishment. He's still an outsider to some extent, but he's responsible for what's happened over the last 4 years.
And so about that American Carnage speech, I mean, that was in reference to both the economic devastation that we've seen in various parts of the United States and also to crime. That's not something we've talked about in this conversation yet, but the president has definitely been active on his Twitter feed. It seems like he's going to want to talk about his perceptions of crime a lot. Do you want to talk about that for a second?
Yeah, I actually think there are two things that you didn't see brought up in the Democratic convention that are going to come up consistently over the next 4 nights. The first is what's happening in our cities. And this is not just Portland, which is literally seeing tragic rioting and violence every night and has for over 2 months. It's Seattle, it's Chicago, it's New York, where you're seeing the violent crime rate increase. And so he obviously believes that supporting law enforcement and defending the police rather than defunding them is a winning political message. And I think that's probably right. In particular, it's probably a winning message in the suburbs where he's had some difficulty. But then the second issue is China. I mean, you know, I don't believe that the word China was mentioned until 10:57 p.m. Eastern on Thursday night when Biden mentioned it in one sentence. And obviously, Trump wants to try to deflect a little bit of the blame that he's getting on the response to the actions or inactions that China took as it relates to the virus. But it's even bigger than that. It goes back to manufacturing. It goes back to recognizing that China is an economic threat to the United States and that we're going to be much more aggressive. And people can evaluate that. I think Trump has really moved the country on the issue of China over the last 3.5 years. And in fact, I think Biden might even be boxed in strategically in terms of the options he will have available to him if he does win. So I think those are two issues that you will see prominently featured over the next 4 nights that were pretty much ignored last week.
You know, about crime, I was actually in Portland, Oregon last week. And the thing is that the little snippets that you see on social, not just social media, but even covered in the media more broadly, in reality, it's confined to a couple of blocks area in downtown Portland. The entire rest of the city is happily living its life on a daily basis. So this idea that there's a sort of a crime-ridden urban warfare, this festering wound of depravity taking over American cities, just doesn't track with reality at all. And that's why I'm wondering, like, it's not something that I don't think is going to have traction beyond, again, the president's base, because what people are seeing, literally the people who live in those cities are seeing, what they're seeing is pretty much the opposite of what the president's focusing on.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a question of how many city blocks are consumed by the violence we're seeing in these cities. I think it's more about the perceptions that people are feeling about whether law and order, you know, truly is restored in these cities, whether they feel personally at risk, whether they feel like their safety is being made better or made worse, and how the defund the police movement figures into all of that. Look, if defund the police was a winning political message, Biden and the Democrats would be wholeheartedly and publicly for it. And when that started, they have done everything they can, including last night on ABC News, to say that they are not in favor of defunding the police. They appear to be in favor of transferring money from the police to social services, which is effectively defunding the police. But look, you're correct that this idea that every city, you know, is a chaotic nightmare and people are immediately at risk is not truthful. But I just think the energy on the left is about trying to, at a minimum, reform policing, but perhaps go even further than that, as Minneapolis has, as Seattle has.
Well, Matt Makowiak, Republican strategist and president of Potomac Strategy Group and chair of the Travis County Republican Party, with us today from Austin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Take care.
Phil Rucker, hang on here for just a second. We have to take a quick break. I'll get some responses from you to what you heard Matt say when we come back, and we'll also check in on what's happening in Pennsylvania as well. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about day one of the Republican National Convention. Of course, the RNC kicks off today, and the case that the GOP will be making for the reelection of President Donald Trump. Phil Rucker joins us. He's White House Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. And Phil, before the break, you heard Republican strategist Matt Makowiak there talk about how the president is likely to talk about his views on crime and disorder in American cities. And Matt did concede the fact that what the president focuses on in terms of the clashes between protesters and law enforcement, and we've covered that extensively on this show about what's actually happening on the ground there in terms of law enforcement's use of power, but those sort of circumscribed events aren't at all indicative of crime in American cities overall, which, as we know, statistically has been heading down. But Matt acknowledged that, like, the facts don't really matter here. It's about how people feel regarding their safety. So once again, it seems to be there's this tension between what strategists say that the president needs to do, which is reach out beyond his base, versus what he does do, which is really hone in on messages that resonate with his base. I just wondered what you thought about that specifically through the lens of how the president talks about crime.
Well, you're right to point out the disconnect between the reality in America's cities and the picture that the president is painting of it. You know, what the president's really trying to do here is appeal to a very clear set of voters. He wants to win back support from white college-educated women who live in suburbs and exurbs around the country. They have peeled away from him in large numbers, and over the past several years, they voted for a lot of House Democrats. That's one of the reasons why Nancy Pelosi became the Speaker again, and Democrats won back the House majority. Trump is trying to win them back in his presidential run, and he's trying to use fear to do so, and he's trying to make suburban mothers, suburban women, fearful that there are going to be riots in their streets and that there are going to be protesters marching through their cul-de-sacs and that there'll be embers and gas canisters and all that sort of stuff playing out in their suburbs. In fact, the president has gone so far as to say if Biden is elected, he will get rid of the suburbs. The suburbs will be no more. And setting aside sort of how ridiculous that particular line is, because obviously a president can't eliminate suburbs and make them vanish, it's a fear attempt. And we're going to see that play out at the Republican convention because one of the speakers is the McCloskeys. This is the couple from St. Louis who gained viral fame a few weeks ago because they stood outside of their home in suburban St. Louis holding up firearms and pointing their guns at Black Lives Matter protesters who were passing by their neighborhood.
I'm pausing here, Phil, because I'm just trying to understand how it's possible that over the next 4 days, the RNC is going to try to pull off a convention where it's a convention for President Trump. I mean, Matt mentioned the 50-point plan, which is it's not a platform. It's basically acknowledging fealty to whatever the president's agenda is. I mean, this is really going to be 4 days of celebration of Donald Trump. And just,
that's
you know,
right.
Even just on this point, on crime, looking at his Twitter feed, as you well know, there's no, he doesn't hide the link between amping up fear about crime and race. I mean, you're talking about the issue of seizing Joe Biden's going to get rid of the suburbs. He talked about keeping affordable housing out of the suburbs. I mean, these are all things that race is the explicit undertone. I mean, are we not bound to see that during the convention itself, or is the GOP going to try as hard as it can to keep that out?
I think we're certainly going to see it. Not only does Trump not hide the link to race, he says it out loud and he makes the link for you. And you mentioned the housing policy. He kind of out of nowhere dropped the name Cory Booker as the person who's going to be hurting the suburbs. Well, Cory Booker happens to be an African-American, a black man, a senator from New Jersey. So, he's connecting those dots for us. And it's a very deliberate effort to galvanize white supporters who are fearful of what they see playing out in this country with the demographic changes, with the browning of America. And he's trying to stoke those anxieties and those fears that some white people have for his own political gain. It's been a deliberate strategy of Trump's for years now, but especially so now. So I assume we're going to see that. And one other point, you mentioned the idea of a platform. I don't know how many of your listeners have paid this close attention to the convention, but they actually, the Republican delegates actually voted on a platform at the very beginning of their convention yesterday, I believe. And it's not even a platform. But they basically said, we're not going to have a party platform this year. Instead, we're just going to, we're going to state our full enthusiastic support of President Donald J. Trump. And so the Republican platform has literally, in writing, become fealty to Donald Trump.
Well, for On Point listeners, I'm going to dangle this tantalizing tidbit in front of you. Our entire show tomorrow is going to be about exactly that, the non-platform platform that the GOP has decided on for this convention. We're going to give you an hour diving into that because it's actually a really interesting story about where the Republican Party is right now as an American political party. So that's for tomorrow. I did want to ask you a couple other quick questions, and then we're going to jump to Pennsylvania here in a second. But Phil, there's some other unorthodox things that we will see here in the RNC, let alone the fact that just by virtue of the pandemic, the whole convention, like we saw with the Democrats, is going to be unorthodox from top to bottom. But specifically regarding political orthodoxy, let's talk about for a second that the president, that Donald Trump is going to be giving his, at least one of his speeches from the White House itself. Now, this has caused quite a bit of consternation. Do you want to talk about that for a moment?
Yeah. So this is, yet another thing in the Trump presidency without precedent. The president is going to be delivering his formal acceptance speech Thursday night from the South Lawn of the White House. Traditionally and as part of the norms of this country, federal property, including the White House, is not to be used for political purposes. There's actually a federal law, the Hatch Act, that prevents federal employees from participating in political events or sort of using their federal offices or federal resources for politics. The president himself is exempt from that law. And so that's one of the ways that Trump's lawyers are arguing that it is appropriate and okay and legal and permissible for him to do his speech from the South Lawn. But nonetheless, it's raised a great deal of ethical concerns. Other concerns as well, though, and other breaks with precedent. The sitting Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, is planning to address the Republican convention from Jerusalem in Israel. You know, we're not used to seeing national security figures or secretaries of state while they're in office address political conventions. They're supposed to stay out of politics, but Pompeo has his own presidential ambitions. And I think there's a desire by the Trump team to use every bit of the power of incumbency, including the fact that you can have the nation's top diplomat live from Jerusalem address the convention, to use those tools to his benefit.
All right, Phil, so hang on here, because as promised, I want to turn now to Pennsylvania. Julia Taruso joins us. She is the 2020 election reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and she's with us from Philadelphia. Julia, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks so much.
So a minute or two ago, you heard Phil Rucker reiterate the importance of suburban voters for the president in his reelection bid. Just tell us a little bit about how voters in the suburbs of Philly, for example, thus far are responding to the president, or sort of where, if his message thus far is even resonating.
Sure. So the suburbs of Philadelphia have gotten increasingly more Democratic over the last 4 years, over the last 2 years. I mean, the political realignment of Pennsylvania is really the Democrats concentrating in Philly and these suburban counties. And so I think, both anecdotally talking to voters and also the polls show that some of Trump's, rhetoric around I'm here to protect the suburban housewives and save them from, protests in the streets aren't necessarily working in the Philadelphia suburbs. Polls have showed that voters there support the protests, or, back at the height of some of the protests going on in Philadelphia. And these are also suburbs that have gotten a little more racially diverse. So I think there is a bit of a disconnect, at least in Pennsylvania, in terms of whether that's an appeal that's going to work.
Okay, so that's regarding the suburbs of Philly, but more broadly across Pennsylvania, I think I see polling that has Biden ahead, but does that match with what you're seeing on the ground?
So I think there's two things. Overall, Biden is winning by between 4 and 10 points overall in Pennsylvania. But there is also, Republicans will point to voter registration numbers. So in the past 4 years, Republicans have actually added more voters to their rolls than have Democrats. And if you look at kind of what that boils down to, it's largely in areas like, Rust Belt areas, more rural areas where Trump's base is. And it's a lot of moderate Democrats who are officially becoming Republicans, who may have voted Republican for a long time. So, when I talk to voters out there, they immediately, and when I say out there, I mean, you know, maybe outside of Scranton, which is where Biden is from, but where a lot of more moderate Democrats have become Republicans and have backed Trump. When I talk to voters out there, one of the first things they bring up with me is, you know, Biden wants to defund the police, and they are arguably farther away from the cities where the largest protests are happening.
Right. So, can we talk about Scranton for a minute here?
Sure.
Because as you mentioned, it's where Joe Biden's from, and so how indicative would the Scranton vote be for how Pennsylvania goes?
I think so. Hillary Clinton did win Scranton, and she narrowly won the county that Scranton is in, but in a statewide election where Trump won by less than 1%, the gains he made in those areas were really critical. I mean, the areas around Scranton helped deliver Trump a win in 2016. So Northeast Pennsylvania, that region is going to be really important in terms of who wins Pennsylvania. And there is kind of this push and pull over whether Biden's roots will be enough for him to kind of recapture that moderate Democrat vote, or whether a lot of Trump's rhetoric around, like, Biden left Scranton when he was 10 years old will be effective. And my sense from doing some reporting out there is that Trump's base isn't really shifting out there, but that as protests and other things have started, you're seeing some new Democratic energy that could kind of counter it.
Okay. And then, so what about, I'm just thinking back to at the beginning of the conversation, we spoke about North Carolina and how, for example, they have a very tight U.S. Senate race there. I'm wondering if there are some, I've been thinking House races more that might sort of tell us how purple Pennsylvania actually is. I know there's a lot of attention, for example, being paid on the 17th district, right? Connor Lamb's district. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that's a district. It's shifted a little bit, but it's a very Trump-friendly district that a Democrat, Connor Lamb, won. And it's been interesting watching how he's campaigned, because when he campaigned originally and won, it was almost like a hyper local kind of race where he didn't really talk much about Trump. He didn't really focus his campaign that much being anti-Trump because of kind of how purple the district is. And this time around, Connor Lamb was actually featured on the DNC. He was one of those 17 like rising stars they featured on night one. And he's gotten a lot firmer in his kind of anti-Trump rhetoric as he campaigns to try to hang on in that purple district. So I think that shows you that Democrats who have something on the line think that, you know, there is an appetite for maybe more moderate folks to come back to the Democratic Party.
Well, Julia Taruso, 2020 presidential election reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, Phil, we've just got about a minute left here, and I just wanted to turn back to you for one last question. I mean, you're the Washington Post White House reporter. You know this administration better than just about anyone. Specifically, tonight, for day one of the RNC, what are you going to be looking for? What are you going to be paying particular attention to?
You know, I'm going to really be looking for how much of the focus seems to be on ginning up the president's base and giving and stoking some of the cultural issues that get his supporters riled up, and how much they're truly going to be looking at expanding the coalition and appealing to some of the voters that you guys were just discussing about in Pennsylvania, in the Philly suburban areas. That's going to really be telling, and I think it's going to be the critical point for whether the president has a chance to turn this race around.
Well, Phil Rucker is the White House bureau chief for The Washington Post and co-author of A Very Stable Genius. We've got links to his reporting and all the reporting from the other folks we heard this hour at onpointradio.org. Phil, thank you so much, as always, for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.